Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The Bernstein and McKnight Show.
And a little half swing, and he goes. Paul Emmel, the home plate umpire, rings him up, and Breslow strikes out Evan Longoria. He is a very capable shortstop, and Zobrist is down on strikes. And Zobrist is barking at Paul Emmel on his way out. And a swing and a miss, and Breslow, four batters faced, four punch-outs.
Middays on the Score.
Nobody strikes out Ben Zobrist and lives to tell about it.
The guy was unhittable for two rounds of the playoffs.
The 2013 ALDS against the Rays highlights courtesy TBS. The Bernstein and McKnight Show on Sports Radio 670. The Score. Cubs convention is getting started just across the river here at the Sheraton. And a new member of the Cubs joins us now, Craig Breslow, who's on Twitter at Craig Breslow, is the Cubs Director of Strategic Initiatives for Baseball Operations. Hi, Craig. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. How are you guys doing?
Good. With all due respect, what does that job title mean?
You know, I had a feeling that might be your first question. So essentially, I think the job will give me broad exposure across all the sub-departments of a front office, while also taking a look at kind of assessing and evaluating the current systems and processes. And then given that my experience, of course, is as a pitcher, I think I'll also be supporting the pitching on infrastructure, both in terms of player development and then also at the major league level.
How does your CV help you?
I would say, you know, there is, so I was a molecular biophysics and biochemistry student at Yale. Mm-hmm. And so I always had, I suppose, scientific inclination or thought about things very methodically and analytically kind of aligned with the scientific method. And I think as you see, you know, the incredible implementation of new technology and new ideas, being able to kind of vet through some of the noise with a devoted and concerted process probably helps me in this role.
So when you take this job, do you see yourself, do you want to run a team? Do you want to be back on a bench somewhere? Do you want to, are you starting out on a new career? And what do you envision if everything goes right? You're what? Are you a Theo Epstein level team president?
That may be getting ahead of myself. I think what I'm looking for right now is the opportunity to work alongside some very talented people who have accomplished a ton in the game, to learn a ton, especially, as I mentioned, across all departments in a front office. You know, my exposure to the game has been largely narrow, and I think something like this will give me an opportunity to kind of narrow the deficiencies or narrow the gap in knowledge of the game, and down the road I think we'll have to see you know where the path takes me. But the thing, you know, among the things that I'm most excited and confident about is that this job will give me kind of contact with a comprehensive spectrum of responsibilities.
When did you know during your playing career, or was it until after your playing career, that you wanted to get into baseball on the front office side of things?
I thought it would always be kind of the natural progression and eventually the natural transition. I had long thought about transactions and, you know, if I had monopoly money, would I be making the same free agent acquisitions or trade? I was always kind of enamored by roster construction and some of the nuances, you know, that are incorporated into the collective bargaining agreement. I found myself often kind of questioning, you know, is there a better way to do this? And I think that question specifically will bode well in this role. Just the idea and curiosity around, you know, is what we're doing good enough, or is there a better way to do it?
Well, that has also been the quest of many modern educated baseball minds, and finding the next thing, and finding this overused term of market inefficiency. What is it, what does everybody else assume to be true? Where are the holes in here? What can be mined for something where we can outstrip the competition? Is that just a larger strategic thinking issue, the ability to notice patterns, the ability simply because some people can see things other people can't, or is that learned?
I think it's probably both. I think it's also an outpost of this influx of data and information. When there weren't so many factors in decisions, there were far fewer opportunities to get lost. And I think, you know, there has kind of been this move toward understanding the way decisions are being made, the inherent biases that we all face, and how that may manifest itself in draft selections or free agent acquisitions or, you know, evaluation of talent. And so, you know, I think it takes a bit of kind of an outsider's perspective to say, wait a second, you know, are we kind of getting caught in our own inefficiencies? But again, I think it would be impossible for this role to develop in a vacuum in the absence of this kind of age of big data.
Talk with Craig Breslow. He's the Cubs Director of Strategic Initiatives for Baseball Operations. You can find him on Twitter at Craig Breslow. He tweets only about strategic initiatives or baseball operations. Very limited Twitter profile. Wondering, Craig, we've heard something Dan and I dealt with kind of all season with Josh Rosen in Arizona, quarterback for the Cardinals, with a scouting report that came out on Lucas Giolito back in the day with stuff about Trevor Bauer. Can athletes be too smart for their own good? I've heard this in scouting reports about guys, and I've always kind of wondered if that's more an indictment on the coach or the scout who writes that up than it is the player himself.
Right. You know, too smart for your own good is difficult, right? Because if you were actually that smart, you'd realize that you could be more effective without maybe devoting so much brain power to your task. So it's kind of, you know, an inherent conundrum, I suppose. But certainly, you know, it becomes easier today than ever before to become bogged down in information and data and, you know, to be so focused on the rote that you lose some of your innate athleticism. And I think that's what you would maybe call this being too smart for your own good is having trouble filtering through good information versus bad, such that it's kind of creating inefficiencies in your movement, in your behavior, in your training. I mean, I don't think you could argue that any of the guys that you mentioned are too smart for their own good. And that's not because I don't believe they're incredibly smart, but I believe it's because they're incredibly good.
Yeah.
You know, Trevor Bauer, if you kind of watch the trajectory of his career, he's continuing to study the game and learn and develop new pitches. You know, his pitch design is absolutely incredible and should be admired and attempted to be duplicated. And he's only become a better pitcher because of all of that. So if such a thing as being too smart exists, I'm not sure we're quite bumping up against that threshold just yet.
What fascinates me, and especially when you talk about your involvement in the pitching infrastructure and actually working with pitchers, considering you were an MLB pitcher from 2005 to 2017, of where the secret sauce is in combining objective data with the mind of an athlete in the moment. And I always swing wildly on this because I get so excited, you know, looking at pitch effects and looking at so many of the things that the Sport View cameras are able to show us about spin rate and about velocity and placement and all that. And then I sit down and we talk to Jesse Chavez, and he elegantly and so simply explained how he looks at a batter and how he looks at how the previous pitch was approached. And then I wonder where do these worlds start to merge, and where do you get an advantage in how you merge these two worlds?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, the messaging, the packaging and delivery of information is vitally crucial. It doesn't really matter how well you collect information or how accurately you project or extrapolate data. If you cannot get pitchers or any athletes to buy in, then the disconnect will utterly lead to failure, invariably, right? And so I think it becomes the job of a skilled pitching coach, of a skilled player development staff, which I'm confident the Chicago Cubs possess, to educate players, to kind of feed their curiosity, and to make them understand that providing an additional resource is not an indictment of current abilities or skills. It's simply an additional tool alongside many of the other tools that athletes are currently using to help them take a step forward. And I think that can be disarming. And the next piece, I think, is that all of this is predicated upon a trusting relationship, right? It's a lot easier to accept information, especially information that might make you uncomfortable, if you believe that the person providing it has your best interests in mind.
Craig, you mentioned in the case of Trevor Bauer, his development and his looking at high-speed cameras, all this kind of stuff, creating pitches, that kind of thing. Where do you – and I don't mean to grab a hot take out of you. I know that these guys are somewhat divisive in some pitching circles, but we've seen, I saw the graphic on MLB Network the other day, a bunch of driveline guys have been hired from their outpost of pitching infrastructure and research into major league organizations. How do you feel about pitchers who seek the outside input of driveline, who have developed themselves there and their, you know, driveline's kind of leaking into major league baseball for better or worse?
Right. I think the jury is probably still out, but I think there are a lot of really smart guys at Driveline, and if that weren't the case, then A, you're right, they wouldn't be infiltrating Major League Baseball, and B, some of the top talent wouldn't be seeking their counsel. So I think we have to recognize that there are, you know, kind of third parties that can benefit the development of skills. At the same time, we also have to be very careful in how we're vetting and making decisions about whom we're entrusting with both our athletes and our own careers. Certainly, speaking from experience, I sought out kind of subject matter experts in the off season, as it seems very commonplace to say, well, I would see a strength and conditioning coach who's an expert in the field, or I would see a physical, you know, the best physical therapist that I could geographically get to, and that wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't raise an eyebrow at that at all. Over the last probably 5 years or so, you know, especially on, you know, on pitching, the pitching side with Driveline, and on the hitting side with some of these hitting gurus who have impacted major league hitters and pitchers quite dramatically, we're seeing that trend. And I think there are some experts that are worth entrusting with our careers. We just have to be sure and confident, like I said, in the process around which we're filtering out kind of the bad apples.
We are talking with Craig Breslow on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. The former major league pitcher is now the Cubs Director of Strategic Initiatives for Baseball Operations. And we've talked a lot over the course of this show the last year about what velocity is doing to change baseball. And it seems to me all roads, for whatever you want to say, whether it's pace of play or whether it's action within the game, strategy and in endgame situations, all roads lead back to velocity. There will be a response somehow. Major league players are too good. There's always something next. And I don't know what it is. When you start to think over what hitters, what offenses are going to try to do to somehow mitigate, counterbalance, respond to this massive rise in average velocity, what's going to happen?
Sure. Well, yeah, I think you're exactly right in that in terms of skill acquisition or development, velocity is leading, right? The offensive side catching up to the velocity is kind of the lagging party or the rate limiting step right now. But we've seen throughout history that every advance on one side is eventually mitigated by a response. We may see differences in the way hitters train. We may be able to target some of the honing of neuromuscular pathways in terms of reaction time. Maybe hitters decide that they're going to start to use lighter bats, or they, you know, instead of, maybe we watch batting practice evolve from 65 mile an hour feel good about yourself type swings to, you know, finding a machine that can throw a baseball at 100 or 105 miles an hour such that the 95 is now a little bit more comfortable. I think if we look at sports as kind of a free market, we have to give the market a chance to adjust. And the only way to do that is over time.
You mentioned, Craig, that as you step into this role, you've got gaps in knowledge that you'd like to narrow. I obviously, some of that comes from your focus as just a pitcher over 12 years in Major League Baseball. If you could do like the Thanos snap, right? And four other players narrow a particular gap of knowledge, whether that's because from a lack of communication from the front office to players or players to other players, players to coaches. What gap of knowledge in your mind needs the most narrowing and quickest here as we approach next season?
Yeah, I think probably generally, and I don't think I'm sharing trade secrets. The education component around some of the new data and metrics that we're collecting, I think, it's very easy to get caught up in some of the terms that you opened with, right? The launch angle and exit velocity and spin rate and, vertical and horizontal displacement. And mostly we generally have an idea of what that means, but maybe where we're failing right now is in lack of understanding the way that some of these terms or what you watch on TV and by way of StatCast information that's collected, the way that's impacting careers or the way that's impacting younger professional player swings or pitch usage. So I think there's an education component that says this is information that we're collecting. Here's why it may or may not be relevant to you, and here's what we would like to see you do with it. Because I think you can argue that misunderstanding information is actually more detrimental than just failing to collect the information in the first place, right? Making an adjustment because you believe the information is telling you something that it's not might be worse off than just not having the information at all.
Greg, we appreciate your time. I have to mention it was funny that in researching you and your story before this interview, there was a legend that was making its way around when you were playing about what was essentially like a superhero origin story about your eventual interest in molecular biophysics and biochemistry, because the story sort of took on a life of its own, and it became this idea that at one point when your older sister was diagnosed with thyroid cancer, that it's like you got into this to find a cure for to actually like do it yourself. And I read it's like, no, it's just it was taken care of. You gained some interest in it and learned a lot about it. I like the other origin story that you got into it so you yourself could find the cure.
Right. Did I have did I wear a cape and a mask?
Absolutely.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. No, I think there were two galvanizing points that I point to as like why I believed I would pursue medicine. One was breaking my wrist as a 7-year-old. And then the second was my sister's diagnosis of cancer and her eventual, treatment and positive outcome. Unfortunately, I had no part in, either conclusion, aside from in the first one being a patient and in the second one being, a loving sibling. I wish I had the truth for you.
Well, best of luck in this. I look forward to having a conversation as the season in your career goes on. It sounds like it's going to be the start of a fascinating time for you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm excited to get going and work alongside some really impressive colleagues.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks, Craig.
Craig Breslow, Cubs Director of Strategic Initiatives for Baseball Ops.
Good God. He's smart.
Yeah. Could you imagine being like a short A manager and wherever
you got Craig Breslow.
Right.
This son of a
you run your mouth, Purdy. Look, I've been in those minor league dugouts, so I know those guys, man.
Oh my God.
What are you talking about, man?
I think it's 7 years old. I still this guy was like, I could be a doctor at 7 years old. I'm pretty sure at 7 years old I still had a reasonable thought that I could still be Spider-Man.
Right.
And I could still do it. If I really put my mind to it, I could still, the next 10 years of work from 7 to 17, that I might still be able to be Spider-Man. This guy's
do
like,
you guys
doctor.
Need a shower?
We are going to talk, the intelligence doesn't stop there because Mark Deeks is going to join us at 10:40. The fans in London were exposed to something moderately resembling.
There was a ball and it bounced.
NBA basketball yesterday with the Knicks and the Wizards, but he'll have some Bulls thoughts as well and everything going on in the NBA. We always like touching base with Mark. He's coming up at 10:40. Very soon, you're going to have a chance to win $1,000 in cash on the score with a text keyword and it's Championship Sunday.
Yes, it is.
Big games, big names. Historic players, Hall of Famers to be.
I have collected a stat or two about the upcoming games. I think two of them, all of them are good. Otherwise, I wouldn't have brought them. Two of them, I don't think you'll believe, and I'll give them to you next.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
So you claim that these statistics, these bits of football information are so mind-blowing that I,
yes,
Dan Bernstein, will not believe you, Connor McKnight.
That's what you do to hold him through the break. Yeah, a couple of things that I kind of thought were interesting about the upcoming championship games. And I woke up, I mentioned this to Mully and Haw in transition when we started our day. I woke up wanting something very specific from these championship games that I didn't think would really kind of bite into my football soul. And yes, it has. It's bitten, it's taken hold. And it's something that Mike Florio brought up with us yesterday. The fact that he kind of thinks, I'm not quite sure how firmly he thinks it or how much of a possibility he thinks it is, but he mentioned it pretty stridently that if Breeze or Brady win a Super Bowl, that he's not writing off the possibility that either one could ride off into the sunset
right
after so doing. So now I want the old men. That's what I'm in for. I'm in for old men playing in a Super Bowl against each other, and I want one of them to ride off into the sunset because I think the big change in the NFL would be so interesting to watch, and it'd be more interesting to watch with the Patriots because of what would have to happen after Tom Brady leaves and how that franchise would try and remake itself. Is Brady linked to Belichick? Are the ends of those careers linked? I tend to think probably not, but possibly. The Saints are less interesting because they seem pretty committed to Taysom Hill being a quarterback.
Yeah, did you see the quote?
Did you see the throw he made?
Yeah.
I mean, the guy can sling it as well as, I mean, he's not just Tim Tebow. I don't have a whole lot of faith in the guy, but they seem willing enough to do it.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
The bottom of the hour is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. It's rivalry weekend for the Chicago Wolves as they host Rockford on Saturday night in an Illinois Lottery Cup game in Milwaukee on Sunday afternoon. The 25th anniversary parking is free courtesy of Kia. Visit ChicagoWolves.com.
A couple of texts about Taysom Hill before we move into the stats you won't believe about the championship Sunday that's upon us. He is 28 years old. He's Mormon, so he lost a couple of years to his mission.
He didn't lose them. He spent a couple years on his mission.
It's a matter of semantics for some of you.
Didn't lose. I mean, he's doing things that are important to him.
That's true. He also had a Lisfranc fracture, so there's some lost time. That sets him a year back. So he's like a lot of BYU quarterbacks. Well, shouldn't even just say quarterbacks. A lot of BYU players, they spend a lot of time not playing football before they go back and play football. So that's why he's 28 and with so little experience. Did you know that no road team has been in the Super Bowl since 2012? When it comes to Championship Sunday, no road team has advanced to the Super Bowl since 2012. In 17, it was New England over Jacksonville and Philly over Minnesota. 16, it was Atlanta over Green Bay and New England over Pittsburgh. In 15, it was Carolina over Arizona and Denver over New England. In 14, it was New England over Indy and Seattle over Green Bay. In 13, it was Seattle over San Francisco and Denver over New England. In 12, any recollection of who it was, who the road teams were? Eli, Rick, road teams that succeeded in the championship games. On the AFC side, of course, it was Baltimore beating New England, which means it was San Francisco over Atlanta. Both teams, both road teams, went on to the Super Bowl, and then the power went out. No road team has advanced to the Super Bowl since 2012.
Hmm.
You want one more?
I do.
I got one more for you.
Good.
You know, the Pats have been bad on the road this year. I mean, for any team, bad. For the Patriots, specifically bad on the road. Did you know, however, that the Patriots are 30-6 when the temperature is at or below 30 degrees.
Is that at home or on the road or both? Because now I'm wondering.
However, no, you asked the right question. You asked the right question.
Because if you're controlling the inflation of footballs to benefit your ability to hold on to it and or throw it, we could see that sort of sussed out in these numbers.
Not only is our large number of those games at home, but of the 36 games they played at or below 30 degrees, 30 of those were against the Bills or the Jets at Gillette Stadium.
Aha.
So, take that for what you will. You can give the stat you want. It's a beautiful way of playing with the numbers. Sure, Tom Brady's good when it's cold. However, a lot of those wins are against bad football teams and in the comfortable confines of Gillette Stadium where the football does whatever you want it to do.
The 319 texter says when he refers to Taysom Hill as Fred Flintstone, he's saying it's twinkle toes, it's running on the balls of his feet. So like an
when Flintstone would bowl, he would go up on each individual
but
that's toe.
Bowling, that's not running. That's just
he would approach the lane with, you know, a lot of speed.
Well, running on the balls of your feet, if you're an outfielder, it's what they teach you to do because you don't want to run on your heels.
Yeah, you don't want head bounce.
The ball bounces around. The ball dances
right.
on you, and then you're
teach
stabbing
you that
at
long
it.
Long distance running too. Not for any other reason other than you just keeping your endurance up. You're using too much energy if you're bouncing around and stuff. So keeping up on the balls of your feet, keeping your head level, making you pick out a spot in the distance mm-hmm. and try and keep that as level as you can. And that will help you along with keeping your arms fairly low or keep your endurance up, keep your stamina up.
Because your head's not moving as much?
Yeah,
because
it helps you waste less energy.
It's more efficient.
Yeah, it keeps you efficient. You got to keep your arms down. That's the key for
Did
seeing
you run cross country?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. My best friend is a cross country coach.
Oh.
Let me guess, you weren't too bad at it.
I was like the fourth guy on the varsity team. I was okay.
Probably has two state championships.
No, I don't. I didn't have it. Pete was a much better distance runner. He qualified for Boston. The guy's insane.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Coming up, Mark Deeks, our friend from across the pond, is going to talk NBA with us. He's always great. You don't want to miss him. Coming up on The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
So that's the final as Denver wins it 135-105.
Part of our game plan was to get under, make them make shots off the dribble, and they made some of them. Murray got it going. I mean, he looked like Steph Curry out there tonight, making, 25-footers off the bounce. Got to give him credit. Those were big shots. They made two shots on unders in the first half. We felt that was good. That was pretty good for us.
Your plan was to make them make the shots that they made to beat you by 40 or whatever it was. Idiot. What? I mean, our plan was for them to make shots, and I'll be damned, they made shots.
It's starting to sound like, remember the last season of Robin Ventura on the South Side? And I really like Robin. I learned a lot
this is
of
Bevington.
Baseball from Robin.
This is basketball Bevington.
But like every night, you'd have, Robin would do his post game, and he'd talk, and the offense wasn't there or something, and he just, you just got to tip your cap to the pitcher. Just over and over, just, he made some good pitches out there. At some point, you have to do something to stop the other guy from getting into that rhythm.
Yeah, we wanted to go into the screens. That was our plan.
Feet away isn't a great plan.
I was thinking, too, Nikola Jokic, who is just a lumbering lummox.
He is so much fun. What did I tell you in the group text last night? He is going to get giant after he's done playing.
He's one of the least athletic, really good basketball players I've ever seen in my life. He's
terrific.
I mean, but you
that
understand
behind the back thing?
Oh, it's he does once a game. He's going to do something like that, and just the little things, the screens that he sets, the angles that he takes, some of the rebounds he gets when he can't jump over a bagel. This guy, and it's just unbelievable to watch. But if you're scouting him, I don't know how you turn in an objective scouting report where you're adding up traits, mm-hmm. you're scoring stuff like speed,
yeah.
leaping ability, length of arms, like all this stuff. And I don't know how you can, as a scout, go, hey, you know what? I know it looks like Jokic sucks when I add all this stuff up, but you got to trust me. He's really, really good. Somehow he is on that list of one of the least athletic, really good players I've ever seen in my life. Joining us now to talk some basketball is our guy, Mark Deeks, who is on Twitter at Mark Deeks NBA, basketball analyst for Sham Sports. And I just have to say on behalf, Mark, of the United States of America, I apologize for exporting Knicks and Wizards. You deserve better.
You know what? We generally don't get the choice matchup. Last year we had Boston Philly. We thought, here we go. We're finally going to get the premium products and good quality NBA competition. And it's fair to say we didn't. I would like to know who's in charge of selecting the teams that come over to Europe and fly the flag for your wonderful products in our continent, let alone our country. And I would like to berate them because, yeah, not the best. Not the best. I'd also like to apologize for being slightly late on the call, gentlemen. I saved the number wrong, rung someone else. I'm sorry, whoever I spoke to, they were quite angry at me. So here we are now, free and willing to make jokes about Americans.
Speaking of jokes about Americans, we've made quite a few about the Chicago Bulls and at the expense of those in management, those in coaching, and some effort issues too. Are we in any way overlooking the effort that's been being given to Jim Boylan and thus Scar Forman and John Paxson over the last 2-3 weeks or so? And what does that mean for where this core is supposed to be?
Well, there's a good way to lose, and that starts from putting forth effort and actually acquiring pieces for the future that are worth something. I harken back to when Scott Skiles took over back in the day. The idea there was that if they were going to lose, they were at least going to lose with a hard-working culture and discipline on and off the court. That's the idea here, I believe. The proof will be in the pudding, and the pudding doesn't taste very nice. So I'm not convinced that is what we're seeing right now. This is repeated heavy losses, and it's not just a talent disparity. The roster is wonky and misshapen, and there's been some injuries, admittedly. It's far from complete, but it's not 9 consecutive losses of 57 points each or whatever it is bad. There's a disenfranchisement that comes from somewhere. Now, I'm about 5,000 miles away. I can't tell you what it is, but on the court, the results are not positive. It's not trending the right way. I don't see any imprint that you can take some positivity from, be it in the results or in the process of how the results are coming back. So I'd like to say yes, but I can't.
We're beginning to have conversations now because it's based a little bit more in reality when people have been around this team for a long time, believe that something may change and that something may be above coaching at this point. It may be time to move on to new sets of eyes on the whole organization, to find some young, intelligent, modern thinker to look over the Bulls and figure out how to de-wonkify some of these things. Who is that next guy in your estimation? We see what's going on with the Nets. We know what Masai Ujiri has done in Toronto. Do you have a name that if you said there is an executive right now that you could give your team over to him and he'd figure out what to do with it?
I would be able to give some names, but I'm not going to for reasons of personal bias, and that's not something I want to have. I do believe you're correct in that. It may be time to look in that direction. This, as you'll know, gentlemen, is not a team prone to upheaval at the management level. I mean, there's been John Paxson and Jerry Krause, and that's the last 85 years of the franchise covered. So there's not one for turnover in that respect. I think more than anything, be it someone new who comes in or the incumbent staying on, consistency is the aim here. They do... The current hierarchy, they generally draft well. Everyone misses on a couple. Going back to Tyrus Thomas 2006, big miss. Everyone misses on a couple. They generally draft well. They're not bad, identifying talent. And they're not altogether that bad at getting value for that talent. I know that sounds a bit odd in light of things like the Ben Gordon and the Luol Deng trade, but relative to peers, it's not that bad. But there's not a consistency with the direction. It is chopping and changing. Look at where we've gone from the Wade and Rondo backcourt to where we are now in a very short period of time with nothing to show for it on or off the court. There, maybe that's a case of inconsistent voices, too many cooks spoiling the broth. Hard to say as an outsider. Again, we can only hear measure the results, and the results are that the team is not nearly as far along as a rebuild as they would like to say that they are and did say at the start of the season. So be it new blood or the old blood reinvigorated, a decisive direction must be taken. They claim to have done so, and there's some evidence on it with trades that began with the Jimmy Butler trade and things that have happened afterwards. But then that is completely discombobulated when you do things like sign Jabari Parker, who blends in no way on the team whatsoever. So where's this going?
I guess the question is nobody knows, but the worry is that the trend that they're on is an irreversible one when it comes to the development of that core. Like the way Jim Boylan's trying to use Lowry Markin and the spots he's putting them in, the offensive sets that kind of go nowhere, the lost nature of Chris Dunn in general. Do you believe that there is a point at which you're not bringing a player back from wherever you've got him to, or are all things reversible given the amount of talent in a specific player?
Well, therein lies the nature of my question of where's this going, because if you do draft a talent in the form of marketing who not only has a high talent level but also fits the new orthodoxy within the NBA, then use him accordingly. You've got the same with Wendell Carter. That's a fantastic draft pick. The Bulls generally draft well and have done for 20 years nearly. But where's that going? Where is it going? Like you say, you've got a suboptimal offensive strategy that's built about outdated principles that are outdated for a reason. I suppose there's some idea within there of going against the grain, but that reminds me in turn of Isaiah Thomas with the Knicks, who famously in Bill Simmons' book said that when he brought in Zach Randolph and Eddie Curry at the same time, his aim was to go against the new orthodoxy that have headed away from post play and beat teams up down low. But it doesn't work because teams go away from the orthodoxy for a reason. The Bulls are not... They kind of were, I suppose, under Fred Hoiberg, at least in the second half of last season. But they're not seemingly embracing new concepts, or at least not consistently. They get the right kind of players and then don't put them in the right kind of system. The management coaching disconnect, it sounds as though there isn't one, considering that Jim Boylan keeps getting contract renewals. But if there does seem to be one in practice, whereby the pieces of the puzzle are not matching the way the puzzle's being put together. Is it reversible? Absolutely. Is it headed the wrong way? Definitely.
I saw this stat that has absolutely blown my mind. We've talked a lot about James Harden with you, Mark, and just how amazing he is and how mold-breaking he is, how sui generis, I guess, would be the term. And this is from statistical expert Mike Garrigan, who says, only 9 players in NBA history in a full season have had 950 field goal attempts, 530 three-point attempts, and 475 free throw attempts. 3 in Gilbert Arenas and Damian Lillard and James Harden have done it multiple times, but only 9 players in history have done that in a full season. James Harden this year has already reached those in 41 games. That is astonishing to me, what he is doing, what he is being asked to do. I'm on record saying I don't necessarily enjoy watching him play. I have an aesthetic issue with how he plays, but what are we seeing in Harden?
Well, I'll give you wholehearted agreement on the short comment about the aesthetic there, because standing around for 15 seconds, throwing in a jab step that doesn't necessarily get any separation, then dropping in the 3 anyway, hey, it works. It's 3 points. You can't block it, but it's not pretty. The game a day or two ago, I can't remember what it was, when they put up 73 pointers and about 32 pointers and all starting from Harden, pounding the ball until his palms are orange, doing absolutely no work off the ball because he doesn't need to because he's never off it. Bench players just shooting threes, even front court players just shooting threes. It's the best of the situation that they've got because they have a talent disparity for a team that was contending last year. They're making the best of it. Fair enough. It's not pretty. I agree with you. It's hard to, frankly, like. Then again, it's measured by results. I believe they're 25-19 on their way up, so that's something. The only reason they're 25-19, though, is the individual brilliance of that man who we know exactly what he's going to do every trip down. At best, you're choosing between 2 options. Go lefty to the rim, drop in the jumper. We know what's coming up every time, gentlemen. It doesn't matter. He's going to the rim to flail or to dump it off to, well, as was Clint Capella, now whoever's in the vicinity, or is pulling in that 3, or when Chris Paul's around, occasionally he'll give it to him and let him have a go at doing the same thing. We know what's coming, and it doesn't matter. And that is the measure of greatness. When you know Steph Curry's pulling up from 35 feet in semi-transition, he does it anyway and drops it anyway, you can't stop it. This was the defining characteristic of Michael Jordan. You know it's coming, and he does it anyway. That puts Harden into particularly elite category, even notwithstanding the statistical output, as you touched upon there, and the streak of high-scoring games he's on right now, which is phenomenal. Even beyond the stats, just to watch the way he's doing it is something that hasn't been done before. I remember at the turn of the century, gentlemen, we were lamenting the dominance of isolation basketball, and we did slowly move away from that. Admittedly, it's different watching James Harden doing it to watching Steve Francis and Stephon Marbury do it and players like that, because it's a lot more efficient to do so with such a heavy barrage of three-pointers and free throws. At the same time, we spent a long time moving away from isolation for a reason, and now the NBA's leading scorer by far is also the NBA's most dominant isolation player by far. Aesthetically challenging, but undeniably brilliant.
Mark, what do you expect as the Warriors get the Clippers tonight and are expected to have DeMarcus Cousins back into the lineup for the first time, I should say?
I wouldn't expect too much too early. At the same time, let's take a hypothetical scenario, which isn't going to happen, but hypothetical scenario where Cousins never receives an offensive touch and just is in there to rebound and protect the rim. He will give up points on switches and in transition. At the same time, just by being a rebounder alone, he's going to add a lot of value to the team. He's an upgrade on Kevon Looney, and Kevon Looney is very good at what he does. a workman, like a yeoman in there on the interior. Straight away, you've got an upgrade in size and talent with Cousins. Then add in how he's going to fit in offensively. I don't think he's going to get much. I don't think there's much point. At the same time, we must remember that the reason the Warriors aren't as good as they have been over this four-year stretch, despite retaining pretty much the same personnel, is the offense hasn't diversified since then. The core has stayed the same. The bench players have changed, but defenses have caught up. And the Warriors' system, such as it is, which is unstoppable when it goes well, doesn't really have range beyond that. It hasn't needed it, to be fair. What range do you need when you've got Kevin Durant, who can hit anything from anywhere at any time over anyone, and Steph Curry, who can do the same from even further out? They're still running a lot of mid-range actions in the ways that teams don't normally do, and that represents a large part of their offensive diversification. So wouldn't it therefore be nice to have someone on the block who you can dump it into to stretch the floor the other way? You should, in theory, have a floor stretched around him, but it can't all be dribble drives. There must be someone on the interior to whom you can give a touch. This relies upon Cousins embracing that. For many years, I think he averaged 5.4 turnovers last year, pre-injury, something insane like that. For many years, he's wanted to prove himself as the Anthony Davis, as the everything all over the court kind of guy, offensively at least. Defensively, he does just kind of stand there. But if they can, he knows what he's joined, and I don't think they've sold him on the promise of come here and play like Channing Frye. So he will have been sold on the promise of you can get us back to our elite best. If you get on the interior, use your dominant size and talent and touch, clean the glass, block shots, prove your health from your serious injury, get back on the market, get paid with a ring in your pocket. So assuming Cousins embraces that, and we cannot say one way or the other whether he's going to do so because he's never been in a situation remotely like this before, he will put them, not they're already back to top of the West, but he will open up a gap to the field if he embraces it. If not, I can't see him taking much off the table, but that would be a shame.
Mark Deeks of Sham Sports, it's always a delight, and I was looking at this story from the BBC just 4 days ago. The number of people who have been buying for £300, buying a preparedness box called a Brexit box to stock up, stocking up on food, worried about food supply issues. I'm picturing you in your bunker with your freeze-dried food.
Yeah, well, I mean, our government are certainly making a mountain out of a molehill and doing it all wrong, but at least they haven't been shut down to pay for a wall. So politically, neither of us is doing great.
There it is.
We're not happy. We're not happy. You're not happy. No one's happy.
Nope. Welcome to the world, Mark. Thanks. We appreciate it.
No problem.
It is Mark Deeks. It is time for your chance to win $1,000 in cash on the score. This hour's keyword is low. Text low to 72881 by the end of the hour. Again, the keyword is low, L-O-W, to 72881. A randomly selected nationwide entrant from this hour will win. Don't text and drive. Message and data rates may apply. I know how popular Baby Shark has been?
Very, very
how
popular.
How about unbelievably, impossibly massive shark?
Okay.
How about that?
And as long as there's a song.
And Hungry Crocodile and An Idiot in a Car.
I have a story that could shake the score to its very foundations. That's next in the Midday Midway. Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s. And each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.